Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
A warning. This story touches on sensitive issues and may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Andy Richards, a journalist from the Birmingham Mail, and this is Isolation, the third episode in a series of podcasts marking the 40th anniversary of the death of the last smallpox victim. Well, this is 1978, and there hadn't been a case of smallpox for a good many years. But of course, the disease was quite prevalent early in the 1960s, and isolation hospitals were set up to deal with patients suffering from smallpox. There was one at Witten, there was one at Catherine de Barnes near Solihull. And at the time, these hospitals were well used. But of course, for several years, no one had seen a real case of smallpox at all. So when this case happened, people were understandably very, very anxious. And the city offered vaccinations to anyone who was concerned about being infected. And so this led to unprecedented scenes. There were large queues, sometimes of hundreds of people in the city centre waiting for a smallpox jab. 2,000 hospital staff at East Birmingham Hospital in total had the vaccination. And there were contingency plans for a lot more too. And some 300 people who had either had direct or indirect contact with Janet Parker ended up being quarantined in their own homes. This meant they could have no contact with anyone at all. They couldn't leave their homes. They were reliant on other people bringing food for them. They were entirely shut off from the world to ensure that if they had contracted the virus, they couldn't pass it on. When the Parker case broke, it had international ramifications because smallpox was virtually extinct. Media around the world pounced on it instantly. But Birmingham was no stranger to smallpox. It had had to deal with smallpox cases in the past, and there were special hospitals set aside for people who had contracted the disease. One was at Witten in Aston, but by 1978 it hadn't been used for a good many years. And indeed, a couple of years later, there were concerns that the place was being broken into, the children were playing in it, possibly putting themselves at risk because of the virus that had been treated there. It was razed to the ground, destroyed completely.
I've sent for you because you've all volunteered to take on isolation work in an emergency. I'm sorry to say there's been a case of smallpox. I'm afraid it's very short notice, but I want you all to be ready to leave here in an hour's time. I think you better start putting your things together.
Here's Professor Sir Hugh Pennington.
You did have to have a facility where you could basically lock people up, because it was understood that the biggest thing you could do, short of vaccinating a ring of people around the outbreak, which often got out of hand, and too many people got vaccinated, the most important thing you could do was to basically lock the patient up and have them looked after by somebody who has experience and who'd been vaccinated, so that they weren't going to carry the virus out, and the hospital itself, like the Catherine de Barnes in Birmingham, you know, was not part of the community. It was a separate entity where the virus wasn't going to escape from that hospital. For the most many years, no doubt there wouldn't be any patients at all. So you just have to make it sure it was clean and, you know, but perhaps didn't freeze in the winter and all that kind of thing. I think some of them were burnt down at the end.
While the Bedson family reeled from shock, medical photographer Janet Parker lay in Catherine de Barnes Isolation Hospital in Solihull. Mark Palin again.
It was a hospital that was actually dedicated purely, simply to smallpox. It was an isolation hospital. It was out in the countryside, down a long country lane, far from anywhere else, and there was a dedicated caretaker. In fact, it was a couple that were given this job, whose job was just to maintain the hospital in working order on the off chance that there might be a smallpox case. And at this stage, of course, with smallpox eradicated around the world, it really was an off chance of an off chance. But sadly, that very, very remote possibility suddenly turned into reality that night when Janet was moved over there.
Leslie and Dorothy Harris were the caretakers at Catherine de Barnes. For 11 years they maintained the hospital without incident, until that summer in 1978 when Janet was brought in.
Hi, I'm Sue Bignor, and my parents were caretakers at Catherine de Barnes Isolation Hospital. I lived with them for quite some time before I got married, quite a few years, and then I got married, of course, and moved out. But during that time, they'd had a couple of scares, and I had to get out. A week before we got married, there was a scare. And they were always on the ready for something to happen, something to come in. So everything was prepared, everything was sparkling clean, and the wards were ready, the nurse's home was ready, completely ready. Yeah, they were very conscientious people. It was home, it was nice, and even after all that happened and we went back, the children, we used to go with the children every weekend, they played in the hospital grounds, they absolutely loved it there. They were single wards. Just one-bedded wards. Fair size, they were. Nurses' home was very big. But I know when Janet was in, there was only a couple of nurses there. Because whoever came couldn't go back out. They had to stay there the whole of the time. I suppose it was a bit difficult for them. They must have been really lonely out there. But then, we were out when Janet's case came in. And my parents phoned me up to let me know somebody was coming in, because we had to keep it quiet. We couldn't say anything. And it was pretty worrying for us, frightening time. They were very, very busy for those weeks. And my dad got poorly towards the end himself, and he had to have tests sent off to Portadown because they thought he'd got it. Thankfully, he hadn't. They were all sort of dressed up in special clothing, which Mum and Dad had to wear as well, because they went in, and that's the only way they could approach her. It's really frightening for her as well, I should imagine. Dreadful. I mean, when the ambulance people came, the ambulance had to be fumigated. The clothes that they were wearing had to be burnt. They had to have new clothes from the clean side to go back out with. Food, it was all delivered to the clean side of the hospital. And Dad would pick it up and take it round. So it was all very, very strict.
A week after Janet was brought in, her father, Fred Whitcomb, complaining of nausea, was also admitted as a precautionary measure. While he was there, however, 71-year-old Fred suffered a heart attack, perhaps caused by the stress of seeing his daughter in such a terrible state. He died in the isolation hospital on the 5th of September.
It was upsetting for them and for everybody there to see the state that Janet was in, and that her dad had died there as well. It was quite an emotional time, because we couldn't see my parents and they couldn't see their grandkids, and it was not nice, was it, Dave? It was upsetting. Yeah. I don't think they wanted to say that much, but they told us the main parts of it. How old Janet was. Well, it's a really severe case of smallpox, and because, you know, they go up in levels, but this was really bad. And her father, they thought, had it, but I'm not too sure, because as I read, he died of a heart attack. Couldn't say anything for a good few days. They did know it was the real deal at that time. I was really scared for my mum and dad. It was just so, so awful. And, you know, towards the very end, I mean, they probably felt it was a better thing for her, because there was no way back. She wasn't going to be healed of it, I don't think. And they did take it personally, because Mum and Dad used to, anything like that would... Yeah, my dad was very tearful, wasn't he, Dave? For a long time afterwards. It's, yeah, I'm sure if he was alive today, he'd be in tears. But they really loved the job. and there was a nice crowd of people out there with him. Can't say crowd because it was only a couple of nurses, and a doctor went in. Do you think it was painful for the staff, everybody that worked there, because she looked so horrific from what I understand? I think that in itself was so upsetting, just looking at her.
On the 7th of September, Janet's mother, Hilda, was also brought to the isolation hospital when it was discovered that she had caught smallpox from her daughter. She was vaccinated immediately, and her illness ran a mild course from which she recovered.
Janet Parker's mother was a mild case, undoubtedly infected with the same virus, but from Janet herself. If somebody had been exposed to the virus, if you get the vaccine in early enough, the immunity builds up before the virus gets going and stops it in its tracks. So post-exposure immunisation was quite useful in part of the control mechanism of smallpox. And you might get a modified form of smallpox after your vaccine has worked. It hasn't worked perfectly to stop the virus causing an infection, but it reduces the risk of harm.
But Janet's condition is worsening. Covered in pustules and in terrible pain, she is having restless, fitful nights, falling out of bed while apparently trying to disconnect a drip. Soon, she goes completely blind in one eye, while the other is gunked up with secretions from her sores. In her third week in hospital, she develops a bout of pneumonia. She stops responding to questions. She has no more words. She is passing copious amounts of urine. Her respiratory movements are poor. She is making involuntary picking or grasping movements with both arms. She is so infectious she can only be approached by medical staff in protective clothing, rubber gloves and face masks. The hospital accepts no visitors. After almost 3 weeks in hospital, Janet Parker dies at 3:50 on the morning of Sunday, the 11th of September.
When I learned that it was she who had died, this ghastly death, it was an extremely unpleasant shock. Although not knowing her as a friend, knowing her as a sort of professional acquaintance, the knowledge that it was her who had died of smallpox, that it was somebody you'd actually known and talked and spoken to, was a very, very unpleasant shock indeed. And somebody who deserves this either, that nobody. But if you were drawing a list, she'd be very low down on the bottom of it.
Ron Fleet was an undertaker at the Robin Hood Cemetery in Solihull. In an interview at the time, he recalled how he had found Janet's remains. His words are read here by an actor.
Well, I was expecting to retrieve the body from a fridge in the mortuary. But to my horror, it was stored in a body bag that was kept on the floor of a garage away from the main hospital building. She was in a transparent body bag packed with wood shavings and sawdust. There was also some kind of liquid, and I remember that I was frightened that the bag would split open. The body was covered in sores and scars. It was quite horrific. I was on my own, and I needed help to lift the body. I managed to get her into the van. People from the hospital were very wary of helping me. When the day of the funeral arrived, the cars were given an escort by unmarked police vehicles, just in case there was an accident. Well, there was a million to one chance, but they couldn't be too careful. The body had to be cremated because there was a chance the virus would have thrived in the ground if Mrs. Parker had been buried. All other funerals were cancelled that day, and the Robin Hood crematorium was thoroughly cleaned afterwards. It was a chilling time, and something I'll never forget.
Janet Parker was cremated on September the 14th, a Thursday. On the 22nd of September, after a couple of weeks in quarantine, Hilda Whitcomb was discharged from Catherine de Barnes, having missed the funerals of her husband and daughter. To thank them for their service, Sue Bignall's parents, Leslie and Dorothy Harris, the caretakers at Catherine de Barnes, were invited to a royal garden party.
They were invited by the Lord Chamberlain, commanded by Her Majesty, Mr. and Mrs. Leslie Harris, to the garden party at Buckingham Palace on Thursday the 12th of July 1979 from 4 p.m. till 6 p.m. and it was morning dress, informal or lounge suit. They got this invitation and they couldn't even tell us about this. They'd had it quite some time before they could tell us. And it was a big thing for my mum and dad, especially my dad. He was so proud of it. And he got dressed up, really dressed up. And he got a new suit, and my mum did a nice hat. And it was a lovely time for them, and they met some lovely people there. So lovely for them. Yeah, my dad has written a storybook, A Day at Buckingham Palace. Yeah, it's quite interesting for my dad to write anything. I can't read it all. It's a lot of pages.
As the city of Birmingham returned to life as normal, two questions persisted. How had Janet Parker caught smallpox? And who was to blame? The Labour government quickly launched an investigation into the outbreak at the Birmingham lab. Heading up the committee was Professor Reggie Shooter, a bacteriologist and head of the Dangerous Pathogens Advisory Group. The Shooter inquiry started on August the 30th, while both Bedson and Parker were still alive. The report found fault with several safety features. Shooter and his team established that the smallpox virus stocks were handled exclusively in a tiny inner smallpox room within the lab called EG34B, but stored in containers in a freezer in a larger outer animal pox room, EG34. The freezer was next to a door leading to a corridor. In addition, the report found that, disturbingly, staff sometimes moved between the two rooms without washing their hands or removing or disinfecting their gloves and special gowns. Most of the work on live smallpox virus was carried out in a biological safety cabinet. The cabinet sucked air in and away from the handler and then ensured the exhaust air was filtered as it left the cabinet. But the safety cabinet was small, and some work was done on the open bench outside of the cabinet when virus particles were harvested from tissue cultures using a tube connected to a water pump. The fluid was sucked into flasks containing formalin to kill any virus, but Shooter notes that some of this fluid could be spilled on the bench, and spillages had happened in the past. About a year before, a tray of samples of vaccinia virus, which is used to vaccinate people against smallpox, was dropped in the lab. Professor Bedson knew about it, but no one told the two departmental safety officers who, the report asserts, should have been informed. Here's Professor Sir Hugh Pennington.
Well, at the end of the day, it was left open exactly how the virus had escaped. I knew the premises very well because I'd been there a couple of times, and I knew that they were not sort of high security in the sense that we would now regard a high security lab. Yeah, we took risks that nowadays would be considered just to be unacceptable, but most of the time we got away with it. Sadly, not every time. It was really quite modern and well equipped. It wasn't designed as a lab to handle smallpox, although many alterations had been made to it so that it could handle smallpox, and the smallpox virus was basically handled in one small room which had safety cabinets and so on. But my understanding is that not all the virus was handled in the safety cabinet and all that kind of thing, according to the Shooter report anyway.
Andy Richards from the Birmingham Mail.
The Shooter report was the official inquiry into what happened. It was led by Professor Reginald Shooter, who was appointed by the government to carry out all the investigations, and a team worked under him. And they worked very hard for several months to produce a document which extends to something like 230 pages. They were very thorough. They wanted to find out precisely what had happened. Unfortunately, they were unable to do so, but they did come up with a conclusion. It was the best fit, taking all things into consideration. And their theory was this, that while smallpox was being handled in the small laboratory, room EG34B, somehow the virus had travelled via air ducting, which linked the lab to a room above and nearby where Mrs. Parker had been working at the same time. But when you look at the Shooter report closely, it's an uncomfortable read. And it's uncomfortable because you begin to feel that this is very much a rush for judgment. It's clear that he, on behalf of the government, was looking at pinning the blame on someone. Someone had to pay the price. There was anger amongst trade unions. There was concern in the public. There was near hysteria amongst the media as far as the incident was concerned. And someone had to foot the bill. And the way I read the report, it was Professor Henry Bedson who was made the whipping boy. And I think it's entirely unjustified.
Mark Pollan again.
Shooter wrote his report, submitted it. He came to some conclusions. If you look at his wording carefully, he does include caveats and qualifications to his conclusions. But the takeaway message, really, from his report was that the lab wasn't particularly well run, there were lapses in health and safety, and that probably what happened was the virus escaped through an air duct that connected the floor on which the smallpox lab was situated to the anatomy department, which was on the floor above where Janet Parker worked. My reading of the Shooter report is that it is full of vituperation. It's there to sort of blame people for what happened. You know, it actually sticks the boot in to the university and to Henry Bedson, who by the time that the inquiry was underway was no longer around to act as a witness. But interestingly, also, they stick the boot in to the various bodies that had been involved in signing off the lab and saying it was okay. So there was at that time this Dangerous Pathogens Advisory Group, and Reggie Shooter was in fact the chairman of that group. But he doesn't hold back from complaining about how that group had signed off the lab and said it was okay to continue. And looking back, it looks a bit weird because there's almost a conflict of interest here. How could he be investigating a group that he was the head of? He hadn't actually been involved in those decisions. He hadn't been involved in the visitation and so forth. But that seemed very strange. It's almost as if he was going so far as to say, well, it happened on my watch, and I'm going to bend over backwards to show that I've assigned blame and dished all this blame out to show that I'm not being partisan in some kind of way. It's just very strange, I find. He had a similar attitude towards the WHO, and blaming the WHO for allowing the lab to function. So that was odd. The other thing that was odd was that he didn't seek advice from any smallpox experts, or at least he didn't seek substantive advice. And they between themselves formulated this hypothesis that it had gone through the air duct. And again, what motivated them to say that is unclear to me, whether they really did believe that that was the obvious explanation. And it was a tidy explanation, and it explained why Janet Parker, out of all the people that worked in East Wingham Medical School, would have been singled out. But there is a suspicion that it was also a very easy explanation, and it lifted the blame from any individuals. It was one of those things where the building was at fault, if you like, in a way that individuals were not. Speaking to Keith Dumbell, who was a smallpox expert, he said that he thought that Shooter actually took a rather kind of naive view of human nature. He believed in the best in people, that people were generally good, and that when he interviewed people that they were going to tell him the truth and the whole truth. And that was an interesting difference from earlier inquiries. This was not a QC going in there with a lawyer's mindset. It was a microbiologist going and asking people things. And I think if anyone had misled him, he probably wouldn't have thought about was he being misled? Were they hiding things from him? Or maybe he had a kindly view, which was that actually he wanted to avoid blaming any individual and coming up with a theory that let them all off the hook. I don't know. It's hard to speculate. Reggie Shooter died a few years ago. Unfortunately, I never got the chance to interview him about this. But it's very hard to get one's head round what was going on in his head, what was going on in those rooms when they were meeting, discussing this, as to why they led to write that report.
In October 1979, a court case was brought against the University of Birmingham by the Health and Safety Executive. The trial lasted 10 days. The university hired QC Brian Escott Cox to defend its corner. Brian had been involved in several high-profile cases and had a formidable reputation.
I think it's safe to say he was a flamboyant individual. In his spare time, he was a jazz musician. He clearly was a outgoing individual. He wanted to do a good job. He was eloquent in the courtroom. And he not only saw it as his job to defend the University of Birmingham in that very straight way, that's his job, but he'd also, he knew Janet Parker, so he knew this was a tragedy. He knew felt the full tragedy of it, but he also recognised that what had happened to Henry Bedson's reputation was also, if you like, a miscarriage of justice, simply not acceptable. And he was prepared to take up his case in that courtroom as well and defend his reputation.
I'm known generally as plain Brian Cox, not the professor, unfortunately. Apart from his youth, his wealth and his good looks, I don't envy him a thing. But I practice because there was another Cox in my chambers under the name Brian Escott Cox, and in 1974 I became Queen's Counsel. And in the course of my career, I was fortunate enough to do a number of extremely challenging cases, one of which, of course, was the defence of Birmingham University over the smallpox outbreak. In preparation for the case, I visited the university and the smallpox laboratory, but not until September 1979, some 14 months after Janet Parker's death. Of course, it bore little resemblance then to how it must have been at the time. It was still somewhat untidy, but there was enough there to give me a very strong impression of how the laboratory must have worked in its heyday, both the outer laboratory where the general studies took place and the inner laboratory where the smallpox studies took place. I never had any scientific education of any value, so I had to be conducted through this by one of the professors, I forget which one now, talking to me as if I was a small schoolboy. It was essential, however, because I needed to understand exactly what had happened. If I didn't understand it, the university were going to be at a considerable disadvantage.
The decision was made not to have the usual judge and jury of 12, but rather three lay magistrates. Brian Escott Cox explains why.
There were several reasons, but to be short, the principal one was the fear that a jury of 12 lay people would be so outraged and horrified by the death of Janet Parker that consciously, or more likely subconsciously, they would allow themselves to be prejudiced by that and not weigh the evidence in quite as careful a way as juries normally do. And those instructing me, and I myself, felt that a bench of lay magistrates would be a much better tribunal for that principal reason. There were other reasons, of course, that it would have taken even longer to explain all the technical processes of the laboratory to 12 people chosen at random, some of whom might be, I don't mean to be unkind, this is what the jury system's all about, but some of whom might be scarcely literate, and to understand technical language and diagrams and so on. So that was another reason that weighed with us. At an early stage of the proceedings, I addressed them at some length and very thoroughly on the need to put out of their minds any ideas or prejudices that might have crept in there as a result of exposure to the media.
Brian made a point of avoiding the media firestorm surrounding the case.
I make a practice, and always have, of not studying the media reports about a case that I am actually currently involved with. And I kept to that during this case. And I, frankly, not to this day do I know exactly how the media covered it.
Outside of court, the former barrister's lifelong passion has been jazz music. In the 1990s, the Birmingham Post famously pictured him in wig and gown, playing his beloved trumpet outside Stafford Crown Court, a photo now on his study wall.
I've been playing ever since I was a member of the Oxford University Jazz Club band in 1950. That makes 67 years of playing jazz. I can't really grumble too much if I've got to hang up my boots now. And what I'd like to do is to play a good old traditional New Orleans jazz dirge of the sort that used to be played at New Orleans funerals 100 years ago, and play it in honour of Janet Parker. Rest in peace, Janet Parker. Professor Bedson's death was horrific, and in the result, quite unnecessary, because however Janet Parker caught her fatal dose of smallpox, there is no evidence to suggest it was as a result of any negligence or lack of care on behalf of anybody in the university, let alone Professor Bedson. Of course, the fact that he committed suicide was not unnaturally taken by the media as an admission of guilt. He wouldn't have done it if he hadn't known that he was responsible. That is not true. He was an extremely caring man. And yes, it was certainly not in my instructions to do so, but I was aware of it, and I felt it was part of my duty, where I could, to emphasise what a careful and caring man he was. What I submitted to the magistrates at the end of my speech was based on evidence, in the sense that many people who came forward and gave evidence at the hearing all praised Professor Bedson for his skill, for his care, and for his standards of safety and his concern for safety. So this, although the words are mine, they were based solidly on evidence that had been given in the case. What I said was this: the work that Professor Bedson was doing was of great importance. We all know that. He was supported actively by the World Health Organization and the Medical Research Council. He was carrying out work with facilities provided for him by the university, and I suppose in these days, and probably always, there is not the least reason in the world why we should not be very proud of that fact, that these Britons have been in the forefront of this research and have been in the forefront of eradicating smallpox from the world. And men like Professor Bedson and his three colleagues are the men who were there, as it has been described to us in this case, pushing back the frontiers of scientific and medical knowledge to bring about these wonderful things, following in the fine tradition that this country can be proud of. I'm not just saying this for emotional reasons. The university provided the facilities for Professor Bedson, and in choosing him to use and run those facilities, you might think that they might have been able to choose another man as good. They would have been hard-pressed to choose a better man, a man of greater standing, a man of whom nobody has anything but respect and praise. The procedures he carried out, his great care, his great concern for the safety of others, all show that the university placed in him, in the right man, every confidence that their laboratory would be used in a safe and proper manner. No evidence has been called in this case, in my submission, which proves to the contrary. That university has a great reputation, and rightly so, not merely in this city where we can be justly proud of it, but elsewhere. It is not just a question of the burden of proof in this case, but I would ask your worships to say that the great reputation can go on, unsullied by any finding of guilt, all these allegations that have been made and which are far from proven.